you know, facts can be very cold. They don't, and they actually often do the opposite of evoking empathy. They just make it seem hopeless, which we can't afford. That is, hopelessness is not an option here. We can't do anything that fosters hopelessness.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm delighted with today's guest who will introduce himself. John, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'm John Coonrod. I'm the now retired from a long career at the Hunger Project, and I chair two boards, Sarvodia USA and the Movement for Community-Led Development's U.S. Association.
Yeah, and you know, and we know each other for quite a long time, John. And we were just before we started the recording, you know, realizing that we have a lot of areas where we're in common, and also countries that we have visited. Never at the same time, I think. Well, the US is still a visit for me, although I've been living here now for 14, 15 years. But what I find fascinating, John, is and I was at one of your retirement parties, although it was a Zoom. An amazing career. But what I like is, and I don't know if it was at the same time, but around the same time, but you published a book, How the Road Built Me. I mean, first of all, we need to make sure that people will buy the book. I really think it's worthwhile. Although I confess to you, I haven't read everything as yet, but I read quite a lot. And in the book, you know, you share your story so far by, you know, listing, all or many of the people that have inspired you and mentored you. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, why did you write the book? And I think if we start talking, we will also understand more about where you were born, you know, what did you do, and what are you planning to do when you grow up? So, tell us.
Those are good questions.
Take us on the road.
I had no long-term intention to write a book. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a journey in their life, and I know Isaac Dennison's once said that, you know, any life worth living is a story. And certainly I've always going back to my childhood, I've always had this experience of being unusually lucky, you know, and sometimes people talk about sort of having to struggle to find what their destiny is or what they should be doing with their life. I have never had that problem. I've had kind of life tell me what it wanted me to do. And through my teachers, through people I've met, through incidents I've had in my life, it all just seems to be preordained as I'm a recovering Presbyterian. I'm no longer a Presbyterian. I'm an Episcopalian now. So I don't talk about predestination. But in the case of my life, it really seems to have been you know, that I've stumbled onto such inspiring people. And I've worked, probably the person I've worked most closely with is Dil Majumdar in Bangladesh. And, you know, they have a tradition in Islam that, you know, a man's life isn't complete unless he writes a book. Mm. And so Dil's written several books. And he was bugging me to write a book. And I realized that I have so benefited, not just from having mentors, but mentors who who really trained me with their stories. They would tell stories that of kind of their own awakenings to human dignity and mm-hmm. to how development, for example, is being done wrong or it being done right. And those stories I then use. So all of my career has really been kind of being a mouthpiece for other people's stories. And many of those people are now, as they say in India, no more. They passed away, many of them before the invention of Wikipedia. So therefore, nobody has a chance to ever hear about them. So I felt an obligation to really write down their stories in a way that I've been using them and repeating them to people mm-hmm. over the last 50 years.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, and some fascinating stories. I would like to go, you know, you talk about this period as well, but I would, you know, I would label it as pre-career, you know, January 31st, 1951. So what happened?
Well, I was born. Very, very important in my own life. And, you know, I was born in a very smug little American suburb, mm-hmm. an inner suburb of St. Louis, Webster Groves. And it's a wonderful place to be a child. Mm-hmm. You know, we were free range kids. I was close to industrial parts of St. Louis. I could ride my bicycle at age 8 or 9 into places that I would never tell my mother, like the freight yards in St. Mm-hmm. Louis. You know, and I had an enormous amount of freedom and that most kids don't have anymore, at least in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think that also was really good for me. You know, it left me with a level of probably an unwarranted level of self-confidence early in my life. Mm-hmm. But it was also a town where I got to be shaped by a lot of really good people. You know, I tell the story in there about my Boy Scout, Scoutmaster. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those adults, Jim McMillan, who treated every child in a way that they felt like they were a peer, that they were an adult. Mm-hmm. And that really shaped me. You know, I forever, as a child, judged other adults. Were they patronizing me or were they actually engaging with me in a way that I at least felt like, you know, I had some dignity in the matter.
You know, when you were describing that as 8, 9 year old, you were cycling, you know, through your village. I was reminded because, you know, when I think about you, I think about you on a bicycle, actually. And I'm from the Netherlands. I mean, even our former, or still he is the prime minister, you know,
I met your bicycling prime minister.
Yeah, he cycles to work. But you are one of the few Americans that I know that that cycle to work, at least on the East Coast. So, so that's kind of interesting. So John, then, you know, you grow up.
Right.
And yeah, why do you decide to study, you know, and how did you end up ultimately in this work? Can you talk us through that a bit without giving too much away, you know, about the book?
It was. So when I was 13 years old mm-hmm. and still a Boy Scout, I went to the Boy Scout Jamboree, which is a big gathering of mm-hmm. scouts from all over the country and in many places from other countries as well. And we went to the New York World's Fair, and I've met so many people whose lives were changed at the New York World's Fair. This is not the 1939 one, but the 1964 one. And one of the things that was I came across was this concept of controlled thermonuclear fusion, which is starting to now be in the news again. But at the time, the General Electric Company was really promoting it. And they posed the question, was I aware that the Sahara Desert is more intrinsically fertile than the San Joaquin Valley of California, the most productive agricultural region on Earth? And if we had a source of clean, cheap electricity, then we could desalinate seawater, we could irrigate the Sahara Desert, and you could feed the whole world just from the Sahara Desert. Well, this was a time where the news was filled with stories of famines, particularly Biafra, other famines. And so this idea got landed in me at a very early age that that there was no excuse for there being hunger in the world. And two, that gee, I could play a role. I could become a physicist and work on controlled thermonuclear fusion. So that was the career choice I made at age 13, which is a good time to make that choice because, like ballet, if you haven't made the choice by 13, you're not going to make it. Physics is a kind of very regimented career path. So, you know, people say, well, how did you get from being a working physicist to being a staff member at the Hunger Project? And it was really the other way around. I was raised to be concerned about world hunger, and becoming a physicist looked like a good way to address that problem. It was, you know, ultimately an inaccurate decision, but it really did equip me with a lot of handy skills.
Like
coding. So before I finished college, I had built I'd helped build the first whole body CAT scanner. I had built the world's fastest computer. And so I came up with a whole bunch of useful skills for the physics profession that, you know, I still have the opportunity to use every day.
Okay.
When you're in development, you have to have monitoring and evaluation and learning systems. So I coded all those for us.
Great. You know, you end up, well, you know, we were alluding to, or I was alluding to your retirement party. You're still involved in the movement for community-led development. So I would like to talk about it a little bit later, but first focus on your work at the Hunger Project. If you look back now, John, what are you most proud of?
So I am most proud of having worked for an organization that was deeply grounded in human dignity. Human dignity requires the recognition of people's own agency, that people are, you know, we have this grid. As kind of, you know, what is traditional, conventional, patronizing styles of helping people, treating people as, quote, beneficiaries, treating women as targeted beneficiaries. I mean, there's all this traditional jargon in the development space that is horrifically disempowering. I mean, it doesn't treat people as human beings. And one of the stories in the book is related to a man named Anasir Rahman, who I've had the privilege of meeting, but I read his stuff long before, as we were kind of designing our co-designing our programs with various countries. But he tells a story of the Bangladesh famine, and he was a member of the first planning commission of Bangladesh after independence, and he was immediately thrust in the role of coordinating humanitarian assistance in Bangladesh. And humanitarian assistance can be very frustrating, can be sometimes dangerous, but it also leaves people with a real sense of being a hero, of being a rescuer. And he very much felt that. And he went out to the villages during this time, and people just reviled him. He said, well, but why? And they said, well, you know, we fought for our independence, and you have turned us into beggars. And he said, but, you know, there was a famine. I mean, if somebody in your village fell into this lake, wouldn't you throw them a rope? And they looked at him like he was a total idiot and said, well, no, I mean, that happens here frequently. And we know that what you do in that situation is you jump in the water with the person and you swim with them over to the side, because to do anything else would be to destroy their dignity, and what would they have to live for? And that was like, whoa, that, talk about the power of a story. I've told his story to so many other people. Mm-hmm. And it really encapsulates what development with dignity really means, is that you aren't ever doing things, quote, for people. You are doing things with people. And this applies to people with disabilities, to even children, you know, that I realized that one of the things that we're really losing in the last 50 years is centering our work in human dignity and really having a deep understanding of what that means. And Professor Anasarama's story just so deepened my appreciation. You know, as I mentioned with the Boy Scouts, Jim McMillan, you know, there are good Boy Scout leaders and bad Boy Scout leaders. I was really lucky to have a good one after he retired. Then I briefly had a really bad one. So it was kind of, but at that level, I really wouldn't be able to have explained it to anyone or shared that journey with anyone when I was 11. But after reading Anasarama's writings and meeting him, I was really nailed it. And that's the whole Gandhian approach. You know, you read Gandhi and it's all about restoring people's dignity, reawakening people to their own dignity. That's what decolonization is all about, is reawakening people to being a stand and a commitment to their own dignity. And that's what Black Lives Matter was about here in the United States. So there's so many movements have that. And yet, you know, there's so many indignities in our world and so many people who are not committed to human dignity and really think authoritarianism and this kind of patriarchal approach to leadership is the right thing to do. And, you know, I once had the privilege of having dinner with the in a small group setting with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And I was saying to him, you know, he was telling me about what's on his to-do list, which the person with the most horrible to-do list on earth is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. I mean, day after day, he's got to sit down with total thugs and try to talk them out of their thuggery, right? And I said, why is this happening? And at an increasing level. And he said, well, it's been many years since the Holocaust. People have forgotten what this leads to, what authoritarianism leads to. And it's true, you know, people here in this country, you know, other countries have their own rising authoritarian leaders. And, you know, when people are fearful, they seem to think that that's a good idea. And as we know from history, it is really not a good idea. It's a story that never turns out well, ever. And that we have to devote ourselves to reawakening our own abilities to tell the story of human dignity and why it is what makes us human. It is the very essence of being human.
I'm trying to push you a bit, John. So I understand. So, you know, I feel lucky that I've worked for an organization where human dignity, you know, is important. We have learned, you know, where that started, that you got that realization. But then if you look back, and because you mentioned, you know, our sector, you know, in the last 50 years have forgotten that. So what have you done, you know, John, in, you know, trying to ensure that that, you know, is reintroduced or stays there? Or do you give yourself, you know, what type of grade do you give yourself?
Yeah, well, when you look at how slow this has been, you know, there is a constant feeling of failure. And I think I somehow have been wired with an excess of optimism. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when we really, the Hunger Project went through many cycles of reinvention. We would come across something we were doing that had, you know, unintended consequences and that we needed to redesign ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we went through that many times. And I think it depends if you grade on a curve or not. So, yeah. You know, I hate grading and I think it's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. I know that I have been very lucky to have mm-hmm. been in a position to really be part of recreating programs that are built on human dignity. You know, when we started in the Hunger Project after the Bangladesh famine, we and many other groups knew from the beginning that that who ends hunger in the world are the hungry people themselves. That's what ends hunger, not the scientists who create useful things. They contribute a lot. But even if you look at the Green Revolution, which had its pros and cons, but it was the implementation of it was through farmer to farmer sharing. You know, it wasn't that M.S. Swaminathan and Norman Borlaug personally went up to every farmer. Mm-hmm. They got the farmers together and co-created the implementation and then got the funding to enable those farmers to share what they were doing with other farmers, and it halted famine in Asia. You know, it was, and now, you know, Swaminathan, who was one of my favorite mentors because he really modeled being a humble and dignified scientist, but he knew that it was ultimately people themselves, and particularly women themselves, who were the problem solvers, were the people who were going to solve these problems. And so many of the people that I admire knew that, and I was so privileged to get to participate in that, in so many different countries and so many different contexts with so many great local community leaders. And so that's why I felt obligated to write the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you know, those of us who do Wordle every day, it gives you two scores. How much of your Wordle was skill and how much of it was luck? And I feel that our programs have been very, very successful. And my role in it was that I was really lucky. I was able, like a little bee going from flower to flower, you know, I was able to distill people's wisdom and share it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know, and I've worked with you, you know, and I feel confident in saying that from my point of view, you're a champion, John. So I was pushing you a bit, but I think what I always appreciate is, you know, this podcast is called Walk, Talk, Listen. And I think you have, you know, shown that you can all do all three. So, and especially what I always appreciate, and that, you know, you described it also in the book, is, you know, the acknowledgement that ensuring that, you know, women have a place around the table, and, you know, and that discussion has gone further than that. It's now, you know, we're looking at the whole gender spectrum, and rightly so. But I always appreciated that, in ensuring that not only voice and choice, we work on that, but also on agency. So that's great. Can you, because last week we met each other, we were on the same panel during the Commission on the Status of Women 68. So I've seen in over the years, you know, some progress has been made, but also there seems to be, you know, steps back that, you know, we're going back into time, it seems. I mean, we don't even have an agreement at the moment that we speak. They still have to get together to come, you know, to the final document. So what do you see as, describe what you see as the challenges around, you know, gender development and you know, the role of women and girls within this?
When I was in college, it was at the very early beginnings of having co-educational dormitories. You know, always before that, there were men's dorms and women's dorms. And even when I started college, there were men's dorms and women's dorms. But the woman who had the room right across the hall from me was Gloria Watkins, who became known as Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks was one of the really great Black feminists in this country. And she was, right, even as I knew her, she was starting her book, Feminism is for Everyone. And she recognizes that if you get 50 feminists in a room, you'll get 100 definitions of feminism. But she provided the most clear one, and that is that feminism is the recognition that that the suppression of women, the mistreatment of women, is not an accident, but a feature of built-in systemic injustice that needs to be confronted and transformed. So, and that recognition, you know, fortunately, I got schooled early in that, and it was, you know, in a very male-dominated world. Mm-hmm. There were not, you know, in my physics department, we were 50 in undergraduate school. We were 50-50. Sally Ride was in my cohort of undergraduate physicists. But that was very unusual. As soon as I got to graduate school, it was 97% to 3% male domination. And then when I was working for the Hunger Project, and we recognized, just from, you know, direct observation, that women were doing all the work in rural communities in particular, and that was kind of a grave injustice built into these ironclad roles. But I think the Beijing conference, and so our own programs in the Hunger Project, were very much women-centered. They focused on women. They, because, you know, everybody in our field knew that if you can improve the lives of women, it improves the lives of everyone. If you can improve the education of women, it improves the education of everyone. We didn't, at that point, I think, recognize the depth of evil that patriarchy is. And it was at the Beijing Women's Conference, and Joan Holmes, our boss, was there, and I prepare her for that, but I wasn't there. And but she got us on the phone, actually, from Beijing, and the males in the organization, she said, okay, get the guys in the room. So she got the guys in the room. Most of our staff are always women, but she got the guys in the room around the conference phone, and she said, look, I don't know in what way, but I do know that Beijing is going to change the organization forever. And what it impacted her was meeting the women who were the survivors of rape in Bosnia, rape as a weapon of war, that there were not just unjust aspects to male domination. There was deep rooted evil at the base of it. We recognizing that and recognizing that we, our programs, and this is, 1995, that our programs, while being women focused, were not gender transformative. They weren't designed to transform the fundamental gender norms in each society that gave rise to this kind of evil. Mm. When push came to shove, it got evil. I remember doing and so a lot of what I wound up doing for the several years after Beijing was doing kind of feminism 101 for men. Because, as soon as we, even in a kind of an enlightened, humanistic organization like ours, when we started saying, look, our number one priority is going to be women's leadership, that shifting power to women in every place we work as the key actors for transforming these gender norms, that was going to be our top priority. And that there was pushback from men who felt, but what about us? What about us? And it was then discovering that you really could, one, we learned very quickly, whether you're talking about New York City or rural Burkina Faso, you cannot message men. messaging, a lot of people work on messaging, behavior change, communications. You can't do that with men. You have to create an environment in which men think through for themselves the repercussions of misogyny and recognizing it in their own culture and committing to transform it and thinking through practical ways they can do that. So it was quite a learning journey for the 5 years after Beijing before we kind of had our own programs transformed. Found meeting with lots of experienced feminists, and there have always, at least for the last 150 years, there have been lots of great feminists in every country on earth, in whether they were Christian countries, Muslim countries, Jewish countries, agnostic countries. There have always been women fighting for their rights. And so we would, in region after region, we would bring those together and kind of workshop through what difference could the Hunger Project make in this, and what would be the highest leverage pathways for that fundamental transformation to take place. And it was wonderfully educative. But Joan Holmes, our boss, she said, because the Hunger Project started with these statements in various studies in the 70s that said, well, you could, if you had the political will, you could end hunger in 20 years. And she said, and so that was our initial kind of mantra at the Hunger Project. And she said, if I knew we needed to transform gender relations to end world hunger, I'm not sure I would have had the courage to take this on. it is really tough. And at the root of it, and we're seeing that, there was a story last night on MSNBC about the brutal evil being done by drug cartels to women migrants as they wait for their appointment in Texas with immigration authorities. Just horrible, horrible, inhuman, brutal exploitation of women by men. And that, once you recognize how deep this is, it then becomes no surprise that it's hard to transform, but it is our duty. It is our reason for being. And for, you know, when you say that we've made some progress and that we've rolled back, you know, it's someone recently, and I wish I could remember who, that's the downside of being old. I can't remember where I saw this, but they said, you've got to stop thinking of it as all of humanity going forward and then all of humanity going back. Mm-hmm. It's really a tug of war. And that there are forces, serious forces on one side fighting for people's rights and dignity. And there's people on the other side who are pulling the rope the other direction. And, you know, it's probably going to be eternal. You know, it's probably, we will never reach nirvana on this one. You know, it's, we can work for that and maybe it'll happen, but we need to be prepared for a long, long, lifelong struggle for dignity, equality, and justice.
Nevertheless, as a world, you know, we said, you know, we need to reach certain goals before 2030. You know, and, yes. And I know you are very often talking about it. I mean, the listeners cannot see this, but I can, because we're doing a video call, that on your backside, you're showing the 17 sustainable development goals, John. So, I always ask my guest, what do you want my listeners to know about the 17 sustainable development goals? So that's one part of the question. The other part is a related question, because I do think one of the reasons why we are not on track, you know, we are only at 15% on average of these goals, is that I think we did not pay proper attention to the ability, skills, and knowledge that you need as an individual and as a community to work on these system changes. And I'm happy that, you know, again, a group in the world has developed the inner development goals, being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting. So I would like to know if you had heard about the inner development goals and then what you think about it. So two part in this question.
Those are two really good questions. So one of the mantras that Joan Holmes, Hunger Project's founding boss, said was that you've got to be willing to wade into the mire of the complexity of these issues and make it simple, finite, and confrontable without shortchanging the challenges. And so, you know, we look at, and the United Nations, you know, many people dislike the United Nations because they see it, you know, it failing in its overall mission of being creating peace in the world. But, you know, I don't think of it that way. I think of it, in fact, one of the stories in my book is about the nun who taught me to think about it as this forum where committed people in civil society drag their leaders kicking and screaming into these kinds of goals. And so the first big developmental package of goals that I'm aware of was the outcome of the World Summit for Children in 1990. It was a package of goals that, you know, if achieved, would have meant the end of hunger in the world. The MDGs were another package of goals, which again took another cut into the complexity of hunger and poverty and came up and environmental degradation, which, by the way, are all different expressions of a patriarchal mindset. You know, oh, it's okay to mistreat the world. It's okay to mistreat women. It's okay to concentrate power. It's all patriarchy. So it came up with a great framework for us to do that thinking in. And the SDGs then in the years 2010 to 2015, the world made tremendous progress. And particularly in Africa, Africa was the fastest progressive region in the world during the MDG era. And that gave us all a lot of optimism, and we did but we knew we weren't handling everything. We learned a lot. We we got together in a very participatory way and did the SDGs. Now, from my perspective, one of the things that having these goals doesn't, obviously it doesn't solve the problem, but it provides a framework of thinking and analysis that can make it simple, clear, and confrontable. And that's really important. And I was struck by the importance of these frameworks when I saw them painted on the wall in Amharic in Ethiopia. Mm. You know, the rural villagers loved the goals because a consequence of the sort of old colonial era, 19th century, many centuries, models of education didn't provoke critical thinking. It provoked uncritical obedience. And the great thing about these frameworks is that it facilitates people to do their own thinking and to not think that it's, you know, you have to do either health or education. You can get the people who love education working on education. And anyway, it became a great model. And we at first used each of these frameworks, and we always pushed for agencies to have holistic frameworks, because you know if you just work on one thing, you know, there's so many foundations and agencies that have chased the silver bullet solution. Oh, if we just did microcredit, that'll solve everything. Well, no, there's no one thing that'll solve everything. You really need to create a holistic system where people are working on kind of everything at once, because they build on each other. So seeing them as a framework for thinking and act, for walking, talking, and listening, rather than as a solution, that to me has been the real contribution of these frameworks of goals. And it gives you metrics to judge yourself against. And when we say that the world adopted them, well, the leaders of the world were dragged kicking and screaming to sign on to them. That doesn't mean that the world adopted them. The fighters for hegemony, for patriarchy, for authoritarianism, they were all still there. And they were just being quiet. And, you know, I don't think, and I think what we've learned in the last 5 years is how much of that is out there and what is driving people into that alternative framework of thinking.
Okay, thanks. So what about inner development goals?
Well, they're, I think, you know, when, you know, and I keep quoting Joan Holmes, you know, she said, look, development is the development of people. You know, it's the human component of this work is a big one. And, you know, is it how we treat each other with respect, how we work together? And they are, you know, and they're hard things. Collaboration is a very difficult skill to learn. We've always, you know, I think it was really validating to see somebody codify in a package, just like the MDGs, to take these human qualities and put them into a package. I think is really, really useful because they aren't, you know, people call them the soft skills, but they are hard. They're difficult. They require real reflection and real commitment to recognize when we're failing at these things and when we're successful and what are the elements of success.
Right. John, these conversations always go fast. I do have a couple of questions that I really want to ask. So if you can help me with being very quick, you know, let's say, you know, a tweet per question. So are you ready for a couple of questions?
Sure.
One is a question of the previous guest, because, you know, I really like to connect people. And the question of the previous guest for you is,
what role do you believe storytelling and personal narratives play in fostering empathy and understanding towards displaced communities and migrants, particularly in today's global context?
Well, you know, I feel like I answered that question in the last one, because, you know, the story that Paulo Ramos told at the border of Texas, you know, we've had our own experiences here in Washington, where the governor of Texas generously has been transporting these wonderful migrants to our city. Seeing those kinds of stories in the news and having people with their own compassion. I mean, this reporter could barely tell her the story. It was an interview. It was so raw and so human. Mm. But then, you know, the first bunch of Venezuelan migrants who arrived here, they're wonderful human beings. You meet them, you love them. But Nady, the mom, arrived with in Venezuela, the reason she decided to leave was that she was holding her baby in a taxi cab when the gangs decided it was time to assassinate the taxi driver, and she wound up with 5 bullets in her. Now, the baby, unfortunately, was unharmed, but, you know, she started her journey with 5 bullets embedded in her body. They were able to treat them when she got to Guatemala, and then treat them some more when she got to Washington, D.C. But, you meet this wonderful, loving, sweet mother with bullets in her baby. Yeah, that is going to foster some compassion in any human being. And particularly when you meet this rambunctious little daughter of hers that would be dead if not for her courage. I think one of the things that's really important is that we in the development world portray people as undignified or not the agents of their own future. And you've read poems, I've heard you read poems about what the courage and the commitment is, that no one will get into the boat if drowning at sea is not a preferable outcome to the fate that they have in their own country. So, every religion teaches this. So those of us who are engaged with migrants or marginalized communities, we really need to up our game in telling those stories, because stories do register with people at a deeper level than facts, frankly. You know, facts can be very cold. They actually often do the opposite of evoking empathy. They just make it seem hopeless, which we can't afford. That is, hopelessness is not an option here. We can't do anything that fosters hopelessness.
Your question for the next guest.
So if this is a tug of war between misogyny and equality, what do you see as the best pathways forward?
Music is very important to me, so I always have a question about music as well. If I ask you to come up with a piece of music or a song that best embodies who you are, who John is, which piece of music or song would you pick and why?
Okay, so you've been to South Asia, and you know when you're in a village in South Asia, you are required to sing a song. You know, it is like, it would be the height of incivility if you did not perform a song. And so the song I always perform was taught to me by a 3-year-old. She came home from nursery school And she taught me this song by Shel Silverstein. It's called I'm Being Followed by a Boa. I'm sorry, I'm Being Swallowed by a Boa Constrictor. And I don't like it very much. So that's my song. It's it's kind of silly, but it does it's you know it everybody loves it. Mm-hmm. It evokes chuckles in every culture.
That's great. Steve Hartman of CBS, I don't know if he's still doing this, but you know, he was examining one simple act of kindness and you know, the potential to create a ripple effect. I have two questions around this. One is, you know, do you believe in the simple act of kindness and its, you know, in its rippling effect, potential rippling effect? And then second part of the question is, if I ask you to come up with one simple act of kindness that you would do this week, what would you do?
Okay. You know, in the Boy Scouts, we are taught that we must do a good deed daily. Mm. And in my neighborhood, there's two that I try to always do. You know, I used to think it was a good thing not to give money to beggars. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, well, you're just reinforcing blah, 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 blah. Very paternalistic notion. I always give money to beggars. So that's a simple act of kindness if you think of it as that. You know, this person, you know, it's none of my business what they want to do with the money. Jesus said, don't say no to beggars, and so I don't say no to beggars. The other is that I return shopping carts. So In our neighborhood, people carry their shopping carts away from the store, and they just leave them as somewhere. And so pretty much every day, if I'm going to the grocery store, I return a shopping cart that I find on the way there. Okay. Now, those are not very powerful acts of kindness, but they do reify in me my commitment to not just walk by.
I'm hesitant because we barely have time, but I still have to ask you about the movement for community-led development, because, you know, okay, your elevator speech, you know, why should people know about the movement for community-led development?
Well, so I think community-led development itself makes sense to people. That is, that if human dignity is based on people having agency, then you need to organize society in a way that pushes decision-making to the local level as much as is impractical. You know, the school hours in a village, those hour, you know, what time of day to start school, that should be a local decision, not a state decision. Building highways across the country, that's a national decision. So community-led development, I think, makes sense to people. But they probably are unaware of the enormous obstacles to that, given the prevailing patriarchal top-down approach that most people have followed. So having a movement of collective voice and collective action to push for the kinds of policy changes, budgetary changes, you know, our hashtag is shift the power, and by that mean shift the decision-making, shift the resources. You know, and we take it for granted here. We've got 40% of public resources in local hands in the United States. That's true of almost all rich countries. In Bangladesh, I think it's like 3% of public resources are in local hands. So it's really important in our field to recognize the kinds of policy changes and budgetary changes that are necessary and create the kinds of collective action in each country to cause those changes.
Right. Any question that I did not ask you that I should have asked you?
No.
Okay. I would like to thank you, John. thanks for making time to speak with me. It's always a pleasure. And we make sure that, you know, your book is mentioned in the podcast notes. And yeah, all the best with everything you do.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.